The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Whole Health Cure podcast, a podcast exploring the science behind true health and living to your fullest physical, emotional, and spiritual potential. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist, and today we're going to be talking about functional and integrative nutrition. I'm joined by Dr. Betsy Redman. Dr. Redman has experience in research, private industry, public health, and over a decade of experience in integrative and functional nutrition. She holds a PhD in nutrition and a master's degree in clinical nutrition. She was chair of Dietitians in Integrative and Functional Medicine, a 4,500-member nutrition practice group of the National Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. She's written several textbooks to explain the concept of integrative and functional nutrition to nutritionists as well as to health students. She's currently the senior manager in clinical evidence at a specialty diagnostic lab and also owns her private practice nutrition consulting business called Nutrition Provisions. Welcome, Dr. Redman.
Thank you.
So we're so excited to have you on the podcast. Let me start by asking you, what is functional and integrative nutrition?
Good question. And they are different. So, you know, we say with the group integrative and functional. And I tend to be more on the functional side, which is more biochemistry, like following the function of a biochemical pathway and evaluating that. For example, if somebody has depression, we might look at amino acids like tryptophan, which goes on to make serotonin, and then the nutrients involved in that, and look at those pathways. So that's kind of so it really is function and getting that function back in place. As far as the integrative, that's really integrating all sorts of modalities about how you're eating and mindfulness, exercise, those type of things to integrate it in the whole in the treatment. So I tend to be more functional just because I'm more of a nutritional biochemist, not that I'm against mindful eating. So they're two different things. So it's a really big pot.
Yeah, which is such an interesting and complementary approach to traditional healthcare. So you're really starting with, well, what pathways involved in the symptom, depression, mm-hmm. for example, and then testing at a level that typically isn't done. In a traditional healthcare setting, what types of testing, for example, can you do? Like, how deep can you delve into someone's biology through testing?
Yeah, well, and it's getting deeper. I think those pathways are getting filled out. So you can look at breakdown products. So you can look at, like I said, tryptophan, and then you could look at those xanthirinate, kenurinate, goes on to make niacin. So you can look at all those markers in the pathway. It's really like an applied metabolomics. So metabolomics is looking at your individual fingerprint of metabolites that your body makes. And certainly there's, it's constantly changing, but you have a realm of about what you do. So looking at, those markers and because those steps require nutrition, so a lot of those steps depend on enzymes, and a lot of those enzymes require nutrient cofactors. So looking to see how those processes are going, the pathways, and if nutrients may make an impact. So we're not necessarily looking at inborn errors that might impact a pathway. We're looking at nutrition and nutrients and if those can make an impact.
So you do the testing and then you make a diet recommendation based on the results from the metabolomics.
Yeah, so we look at, it depends on how much testing you do. You can just look at amino acids, so plasma or serum amino acids. You can look at fatty acids, and there's a lot of companies that sell the fatty acids. You can get a finger stick just to look at EPA, DHA, and those type of things. We have, there's a finger stick test, and you can, you can look at, like, flax is going to be ALA, fatty acid, which is ALA and LA are the two essential. So it's going to break down to SDA, EPA, DHA, and most of the science for benefits is going to be at DHA. So if you're taking, you can take EPA and DHA, but some people, if they're a vegan or something, they just want to take ALA, take with the flax. Not everybody breaks that down readily. So looking, you can just do a finger stick and see, am I breaking that down and getting the full benefit of that supplementation? So you can break it down by doing fatty acids or amino acids. You can also do looking at digestion absorption. There's a lot of microbiome tests out there.
Yes.
And there are a lot of them. Or you can, there are tests where you can look at the whole thing. And they're going to grow in time. They'll get more, they'll get more metabolites. They'll get better at mapping which metabolites are affected by what. Genetic SNPs can go a long way because all those enzymes, generally are going to have a genetic SNP. Some of them aren't going to be as big, like an MTHFR is a big genetic SNP that's going to affect methylation. So there's a lot of science behind it and a lot of research. But there are a lot of other genetic markers.
Yes, and SNPs are just single nucleotide polymorphisms, so just small variants on our genes, which sometimes can instruct us with maybe some changes that we can make. Can you give a good example of a typical person that would come to your private practice, like a general problem that someone may approach you with, and the types of testing that you would do to guide the nutritional evaluation and assessment that you would give them?
Yeah, and I don't, as a rule, start with testing. So I don't want to just always do testing because I get a lot of people worried about getting a chronic disease, worried about getting diabetes or maybe just have pre-diabetes or things. You can make changes. And that's why I like lifestyle medicine, because you can start out by making changes and see what are you eating or how much exercise are you doing, how much sleep are you getting.
Right. If they have an unhealthy diet, you know that their ALA and DHA are going to be low, so you don't need to test it. So, yeah.
Yeah. And even if their diet's not great, it may be that just getting a better diet is going to help everything line up more. So if you're eating a lot of processed foods, you're probably not going to have, the optimal levels, and not that that's been defined for every nutrient. So, starting out by just getting a better diet than the one you have and working to a more ideal diet is really a first step. And looking at testing, you can, for diabetes, there's a lot of research looking at branched-chain amino acids. And they have become elevated with insulin resistance. So they may be a first marker. There's been a lot of metabolomic research, looking at people like with diabetes or without and looking for an earlier marker. Alpha-hydroxybutyrate is a marker that may be elevated long before any of the other markers. And there are other things that can elevate it. So it's not that it's in no way diagnostic, but just kind of looking at all those things together and seeing, what changes can you make that would put you more in line for, are your amino acids in range? So if they're all elevated, are you getting too much? Are they having trouble moving on down the pathway? B6 is big with that. So looking at those type of things. So it's very case by case because at least at this point, that there's not enough big data to kind of plug everything in. You get the results, and you really have to read the results.
Yeah. And the types of testing, mentioned that some of it is just biochemical pathways, enzymes, and some of it is genetic-based. Now, genetics has become an exploding area. I think there's tremendous interest in nutrigenomics, right? So how our genes guide our diet and how our diet influences our genes, both directions. Can you say or talk a little bit about nutrigenomics? Where are we with that? Like how much dietary guidance can you provide people based on their genetic profile?
Yeah, I don't actually in practice do a lot of nutrigenomic testing. I think it can be helpful. I know I found a genetic SNP in someone recently that they absorbed fat kind of at twice the rate of somebody else, which did help explain, why they didn't see results they thought they should get. generally, I still find it somewhat confusing, and there's a lot of pathways that can override some of those.
Well, there's a lot of controversy behind this. I mean, the utility, I mean, I think theoretically it sounds like a great approach to health. The reality, as you just mentioned, we have a very small percentage of the SNPs that explain the complete picture of a disease process. So I think there's complete controversy. So it's interesting that you don't use it you know, very regularly other than in specific cases.
Yeah, I think that it's just not quite there yet. Mm-hmm. And when you combine it with metabolomics, I think that that can be helpful. And I think that's still a work in progress. The study, a lot of times with metabolomics, they'll take a group of people, say, with diabetes or autism, and they'll compare them to a group that doesn't have that. And then they'll just look and see what the differences are. But we're not really ready to say why those differences are there. You know, sometimes it might be markers that are involved in detoxification pathways, like glutathione or something. But we're still not, there's not a definitive thing to say yet. I know the Canadian government had started a lot with metabolomics. And they have the Metabolite site. It's the Human Metabolome Database, HDMB. And you can put in any metabolite, and it'll tell you all about it. It'll tell you what, you know, what the research is, what they think it means. It's like a Wikipedia, so I always go check the references just to make sure. So there are things out there that you can look those things up. But
yeah, and there, you know, unfortunately, is too much out there. So I think sometimes with, you know, if you're a consumer, and even if you're in healthcare, it's hard to sift through quality testing versus testing that may not necessarily be as reliable. What guidance would you tell, you know, anyone interested in pursuing testing? Like, what should they be looking for? How do they know this is a good lab and that they're getting good information?
Yeah, so good labs, really all labs, are going to be CLIA certified so that they follow. There's CLIA and CAP, they're organizations that the lab has to have standard operating procedures, so they know they're going to get the same result and that they get evaluated. So making sure that they have those. I always look for, you know, who's their lab director? What's their background?
You have the inside scoop.
Well, I mean, that's something I've learned. Like, okay, I'm going to check this out, you know, see who's the lab director. And the big thing I do and the thing I recommend to other clinicians is go to the published literature. I always go to PubMed, you go to Medline, Google Scholar, and look and see, are there other published studies on that? You know, are there only animal studies? Are there some labs offer tests that there are no comparable studies? And if there's a gold standard, you want to use that. Unfortunately, a lot of tests don't have a gold standard. They have an accepted standard. And in integrative and functional, you know, we're kind of applying these things in a different way. So they don't necessarily have a standard, but there shouldn't be that there's no research out there. Mm-hmm. So one of the bigger tests that come out recently is the cortisol awakening response. And it tends to be blunted in people who are depressed. So looking at that and trying to work with cortisol, there's a lot of information. There was a consensus statement out there on organizations. So it's not that it doesn't have information. It's just not always readily used. SIBO testing, that's one that's out there now that people can get.
SIBO being the small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Yes.
Part of its problem is that treatments are pretty limited. So if you want to know or not. And then there's, you know, all the microbiome testing. With those testing, people, you know, putting in stool samples, I think it started, you know, American Gut had the first direct-to-consumer. I think it was American Gut. But they look at different aspects. There's some that are clinical and some that are direct-to-consumer. Ubiome, other tests. And they look at the bacteria and the microbiome that live in your gut. So they all have activities that they do, and some are associated with health and some are not. But they're all done differently. even, you know, so there's chiral sequencing, there's PCR, they're all done slightly differently. And even of the tests that are done the same way, they're not done the exact same way. They both may say they use PCR, but they're done differently. So you can't really compare one to the other. They're all looking at slightly different areas, or, you know, since they do the process different, the reference range will be different.
Yeah, and so it seems, just listening to you, that there are really two parts in trying to decide whether you should have a test or not. One part is, you know, the reproducibility, validity of the testing itself. The other part is what can change what you're currently doing, because sometimes maybe there's information, but we in healthcare don't know what to do with it. It's just interesting. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes we find some test that we know is a marker, but there may not necessarily be a concrete recommendation that we can make based on that. So, for example, when we test gut bacteria, you know, our understanding of what's normal, of course, is still not fully determined of what's a normal microbiome. So when we find variances from normal, you know, deciding what we need to do differently or tell people to do differently is still a question mark. So, I mean, I think there's so many steps in that process. How do you decide for your patients what tests to do? Like, which ones are the ones where this type of information is really helpful in guiding their decisions?
Well, I tend to stick to nutritional tests, but they're, you know, are markers that are helpful. I'm just thinking of the GI test type of test. There's calprotectin, which clinicians can use to distinguish IBS from IBD. So that can be helpful. And is it more serious, or, you know, another way to deal with it? You know, there's a statistics in functional medicine that somebody who has IBS, 95% of them 5 years later still have IBS. That they're, you know, if you don't have IBD, there's not a lot of protocols to do, so you still have IBS. But how do you help that person? And I think that's really where functional medicine has jumped in. So do you look at, you know, eliminating certain foods? Do you do testing for that? There's a lot of food sensitivity testing that isn't claiming to be allergies, but they don't necessarily have a lot of science behind them. You can pull up some articles. So if, you know, IgG testing for, I think, IBS or migraines has had a few studies that have showed promise, but it's had probably more that haven't. Is it going to help a particular person? Why did it work in one area? It's hard to say. I like to do overall testing for people who are, you know, really want to see the full picture. Do they look at fatty acid, they look at amino acids, vitamins, minerals, just to see where they are. And then if they follow up, they can just do one area. Generally, you don't have to do a whole full sequence again and see if they can, you know, get their levels in line. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's helpful if you're supplementing to see, is the supplementation helping? For follow-up, as a rule, I'm not a huge supplementer. You know, I think you can get that from diet, but I don't want to discount, you know, supplementing when you need it.
Right, because as you mentioned, I think a lot of people on a typical diet don't get all the micronutrients that they need. So the elimination diets, there's a lot of interest in that right now. I think a lot of people are using that as an approach to various health conditions. And gluten, as you mentioned in particular, obviously has gotten probably more attention than some of the other mm-hmm. types of elimination diets. So there's a lot of controversy between, like, is there gluten sensitivity versus not. So as background for our listeners, if a person has an antibody to their ability to break down gluten, we call it celiac disease, but some people test negative for celiac disease yet have signs and symptoms that seem to correlate with when they eat gluten, and this has been termed gluten sensitivity. But there's been a lot of debate, if you will, in the healthcare community whether this is an entity. what types of testing do you offer, and when do you decide when an elimination diet for gluten is appropriate?
Well, if somebody has a lot of problems, gut-wise, I think that it's fair to start with an elimination diet. And you can either just eliminate the big allergens, or you can do one at a time and see if they make a difference. If it's not an allergy and it's not celiac, it may not be that you have this long-term, I can never eat this food again. It may be that you have dysbiosis, or that your gut is having, dysbiosis is that your microbiome is not the same microbiome you might have had, or a healthy microbiome. Or you may have a leaky gut where your intestinal cells aren't as tight as they should be, so the tight junction between the cells, and things get in and you react to foods that you may not normally react to. So a lot of times just addressing those type of issues can help to, you can reintroduce a food after you deal with the issues of a leaky gut. Zonulin is a big marker for looking at leaky gut. Are those tight junctions there? Are you having reactions?
Have you found the results to be subtle or dramatic when people make these changes?
It depends on, some people can have pretty dramatic changes. And some people don't really notice a difference. So a reaction, it may take a while to have that reaction. I know for the IgG, as if that's in part of the reaction, its half-life is 3 weeks. So, it's going to take time to have a less of a response to a food. And it may be there's other things. I know I've seen research that if you get rid of gluten, you're changing the gut bacteria. Mm-hmm. So that also, it may be that you brought down a specific bacteria that was, not getting along with the other ones. It's hard to say specifically what it is.
That's very helpful. So we're running low on time. I want to ask you, what advice or recommendations would you have for our listeners who may be interested or have heard of functional or integrative nutrition?
I would go to, if you're interested in working with somebody that's an integrative or functional nutritionist, the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. So with registered dietitians, they have a Find a Dietitian page, and you can find a dietitian, and you can pick what areas you want to work in. They also have a subgroup, that's the one that I was chair in, the Dietitians in Integrative and Functional Medicine, or DIFM. You can't just put DIFM in because it doesn't come up. You got to put the whole thing. So they also have Find a Dietitian. So you can find people who have training in integrative and functional
and
nutrition.
Are there any specific conditions, or do you think just about any condition would be one that they could benefit from?
Pretty much every condition, it's in addition to, generally it's complementary with general care. So you're not going to stop all your other care. I think, most, there isn't anybody I would just turn away and say I'm not going to work with that.
And from the nutritional assessments that you do, is there a common, common deficiencies that you see, like nutrients that you think people just aren't getting enough that you think people should maybe pay a little more attention to?
I think minerals are a big thing that, they have research looking at the health benefits of eating, raw food compared to cooked or processed,
right.
Not processed like it's a Twinkie, but just processed like it's been cooked and made into a souffle as opposed to, spinach souffle as opposed to just spinach. And there are different health benefits there. I think the more you work with it, the more you lose certain nutrients. And so I think of like magnesium, potassium's a big bellwether. That people don't seem to get enough potassium because you got to eat a lot of fruits and vegetables generally, or eat a healthy diet. Vitamin D, I'm on the camp that you can get a little sunshine to get that level up because it's hard to get a lot of vitamin D.
Yes.
Just in diet.
Mm-hmm.
So those are, minerals, vitamin D's big. And I want to say folate, B12, especially anybody on a PPI, like a proton pump inhibitor to decrease acid production, We tend to see B12 lower in that. Those are the big ones. Yeah, I'm tempted to just reel off all the nutrients, but then it's, antioxidants, people not getting enough of those. So when there's inflammation, having antioxidant nutrients, vitamin C, A, those type of things.
And do you see that even in people who eat a lot of fruits, vegetables?
Yeah, I can. On my website, I have a thing where you can do an online food frequency survey. It's through a company called BioCare, and they're validated online. But it gives you your healthy eating index, and then it gives you your, which is an index that the government had set up for diets that are associated with lower chronic disease. Harvard's kind of made an alternative one. But the form that I have gives you your general healthy eating index, and then how much you're getting of specific nutrients. I know that, I think I have a good diet. I won't say it's perfect because I'm not really sure what a perfect diet is or, who does it every day. But I was surprised that some of my nutrients were lower than I'd just expected. I thought, well, of course mine's going to be high. I'm going to have a good one. But, there were a few areas and then drilling down thinking, oh, I guess I don't eat as much of that as I thought I did.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Whenever you are trying to be objective versus subjective, there's always a little delta between the two. I think we can all say that.
Yeah, I know I eat better than the rest of the family, but I don't know that I'm the healthiest.
Relative.
Yeah. So, and I think I try to practice that way, that it's, moving to better, not an ideal. And I always try to think, what would my ideal health day be? And I have yet to really define it.
Yeah, so if someone asked you what is the ideal diet, what would you tell them?
I'd want to talk to them and, do some assessments. I think generally eating more fruits and vegetables and more plant-based, less meat products, those are, the way to go. Certainly in lifestyle medicine, they've got great long-term studies looking at that. So it is a good way to eat. I'm a big breakfast person. I think there's good research showing that eating bigger meals at the beginning of the day is good for weight loss. It's good for lowering cardiovascular risks. So I'm a big breakfast person. I try to eat less at dinner, but, my family's not necessarily into that. So trying to eat a smaller dinner when they're like, they want a bigger dinner and nobody wants to get up for my big breakfast. But, having those, I'm not into generally, as a rule, into snacking. So, trying to get those. So I don't have a perfect day. I think there are certain aspects that are probably better for most people and have been shown in the literature, like eating more fruits and vegetables. Using olive oil for olive oil, cutting back trans fat, that thing, processed food. And they're big things, but when you drill down, that tends to get a little more individual based on science and preference.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, that's true. I mean, there are big rules of thumb that you can follow. And like you said, sometimes you do that, and then you're still surprised that you may not be absorbing, or for one reason or another, you're low in a certain nutrient.
Right.
Yeah. Well, isn't that interesting? Let me have you share your website and how people can learn about how to get those assessments on your website. Mm-hmm. So you can you share that information?
Yeah, so it's nutritionprovisions.com. And I have an office in downtown Atlanta, so I don't see patients full time, but I do. And if you go on my website, you can see I have a few things. I have the self-assessment tool. So you can just take that. You don't have to talk to me or anybody. You can just take it and see where you stand to kind of just get a reading of, are you, maybe you're going to score 100 on everything and you're done. Or it might be some other areas that you might want to make changes. And then you're welcome to email me about, the test. I also see clients. And then I have a little string theory weight loss kind of kit. It just lays out, it's just a simple kit that lays out steps for weight loss of eating three meals a day. And you can get the little string kit with it, or you can just read it right on there. So, it comes with a little card with those rules, but you can just read it right on there. It just talks about eating a big breakfast, eating lots of fruits and vegetables. avoiding processed foods, trying to, not snacking throughout the day. It helps with, controlling what you intake, and it's good for your gut because it increase, lets time for what are called migrating motor complexes, so that helps clear out your gut. And then eating bigger in the morning and less in the evening. So it's all on my website.
No, those are good, and those are really good tips. So thank you so much, Dr. Redmond, for joining us. This has been really interesting.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been fun.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by the Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness Center at Emory. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.